Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The traditional rigorous two segments today, William Harton will take the measure of just how much lethal aid the U.S. gives to Israel, with some additional notes on self-driving fighter planes because self-driving cars work so well. And the sociologist Scott Sheeman will contradict many of the things that many of us believe by telling us that people actually like their jobs. We all know that the U.S. showers Israel with money and weapons, but the exact amounts have until recently remained unclear. The Biden administration has been in no hurry to disclose, and as we'll hear, has been making efforts to hide, the scope of the assistance. A few weeks ago, the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Wasson Institute published a paper that tried to put some numbers on the aid, and they're very large. To tell us more, we're joined by one of the authors, William Harton. The others are Linda Bilmes and Stephen Semler. Harton is now a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute. Previous places of employment included the New America Foundation and the World Policy Institute. He also does stand-up comedy. Bill Harton.
Before we get going, we should say that these aren't just off-the-shelf numbers. You had to put things together because these are not readily disclosed, right?
Yeah, no, we had to dig into multiple sources, and it's probably conservative because there's been so little transparency. So it's at least what we came up with.
So how much aid has the U.S. given to Israel since the last October 7th?
$17.9 billion.
In what form? What's the mix of money and weapons?
It's all money for weapons, but some of the weapons came out of U.S. stocks, and then the U.S. had to refill that, you know, pay for it later. But most of it was direct aid, and they moved the weapons as quickly as they could, you know, because they're supporting a war, of course.
And how does this compare with previous levels of aid? And obviously, Israel is a major aid recipient, but this is a departure from norm. How big?
Yeah, it's probably at least four times their normal allotment. They were on a 10-year, $38 billion commitment, so $3.8 billion a year versus $18 billion.
Israel's having a hard time paying for this. Did you look into any of that? Is the U.S. also subsidizing Israel's economy as well as arming it?
Not in any significant way. However, if there's any new commitments, depending what weapons that come with, Israel's allowed to sort of commit to the future based on a commitment rather than actual appropriations from Congress. So the military aid gives them a little flexibility. But yeah, the economy as a whole, there's probably other factors. I mean, the weapons are coming more or less for free, but, you know, running a war economy, not necessarily the healthiest thing for your economy.
So what kinds of weapons has the U.S. been supplying to Israel?
A pretty wide range, all manner of bombs, including unguided 2,000-pound bombs that were dropped on things like apartment buildings, precision-guided missiles. There's a sale of aircraft in the works, but it won't get there in time for this round of the war. It's F-15s. And then there's maintenance of the things they already have. The entire Israeli inventory of combat aircraft, the kinds that are doing the bombing, comes to the United States. And usually there's a maintenance agreement related to that. Usually contractors do it.
Is Israel able to provide these weapons on its own? How dependent is it on the U.S. for its weapons supply?
Reasonably so. Not like, you know, in the war in Yemen, the Saudis were almost entirely dependent on the U.S. and the U.K. Israel does have its own arms industry. It has technically trained people. But from at least rough estimates, they had pretty much used up their inventory of bombs early in the war, and USAID replaced all of that. So at a minimum, they wouldn't be able to operate at this rate. And eventually they'd be quite limited. But you know, they could still do, unfortunately, do some damage if we cut off the money tomorrow.
But the airplanes, they're all American, right?
Yes. So to the extent that they're getting U.S. support, can they figure out how to do it themselves? And compared to some other countries, like, say, Ukraine, they'd have a better chance of figuring it out.
The U.S. has been supplying the full array of weapons from, you know, high-tech aircraft down to artillery shells, hasn't it?
Yes, and also Palantir has contributed targeting and AI-related stuff for their project that helps them pick targets. And rather than, you know, being more precise about the targets, it's basically helped them hit more targets in a shorter time frame, a more intense bombing campaign. And Palantir is all in. I mean, they did a board meeting there during the war, and they've made statements about why aren't other companies being more supportive. So, yeah, the whole range and the high tech end is from the U.S. companies primarily.
An interesting point I saw the report is that Israel is allowed to spend a quarter of U.S. aid on investments in its own arms industry. How important is that? And they get a special exemption on this?
Yes. No other country has that arrangement. I think, well, it's helped them develop their own industry. They're about maybe the 10th largest arms exporter in the world, which for a country that size is significant. They developed a whole drone industry, probably using some of that U.S. financing. It's supposed to phase out, but that's not till 2026, so it's still in place.
And, of course, the pipeline is still flowing, right? That almost $18 billion number that you've come up with is a work in progress.
Yes, and there's more reserve stocks actually based in Israel, which are supposed to only be freed up if Congress and the president agree. But the Biden administration is basically opened the floodgates for that. So that's like right in place, can be tapped. And then there's all manner of excess defense articles, workable weapons that the U.S. isn't using. They've been getting a lot through that program, which either means free weapons or the cost of transportation, or that's going to keep happening. And, things like artillery and artillery shells are being sent to Ukraine and Israel, and there may be a difficulty to produce them as quickly as they have so far.
Now, it's not just Israel that's getting aid in the region, although it's at the head of the pack. There's aid to other countries and other conflicts as well, isn't there?
Yeah. In terms of aid, the biggest countries are Egypt and Jordan. Egypt gets about $3 billion. It's kind of geared to be slightly less than Israel, going back to the Camp David Accords. And then Jordan is a reasonably loyal ally and has a lot of potential security issues. They get maybe $1 billion a year. And then in the Gulf, they mostly pay for the weapons. But the U.S. is a huge supplier, the biggest supplier to Saudi Arabia, and some years also to the UAE, and Kuwait, and Bahrain, countries where they also have military bases. And in Iraq, there is some aid, but most of it was during the height of the war, and it's come down a bit. And there also has been a history of arming the Lebanese army, which is to some degree on the sidelines. They're not fighting Israel directly, but they may be drawn in at this point. So, yeah, the U.S. is arming most countries in the region other than Iran.
What share of U.S. military aid and arms exports does Israel, the other countries in the region, take up? It's a fairly significant chunk of American spending on this, right?
Yes, I would say at least half. I mean, there used to be quite a steady flow to Afghanistan, but, of course, they're not going to arm the Taliban. So there aren't a lot of countries getting anything approaching what the Middle Eastern countries get.
Where does all this money go? In other words, how much circles back to U.S. arms contractors?
Large quantities, certainly half or more, just kind of like touches ground in Israel, goes back to Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, some of the Silicon Valley companies. So in that sense, it's called part of foreign aid, but it's really aid to weapons manufacturers.
Yeah, this is a boom time for them, isn't it? I mean, I've seen a bunch of articles in the Financial Times. The order books are bursting. It's Ukraine as well. It's really a good time to be an arms dealer, isn't it?
Well, yes, because the Pentagon budget itself is getting up towards $1 trillion a year, which is going to be one of the highest, if not the highest level since World War II. And there's a lot of money for buying and researching weapons in there. And then, there's also a near record weapons exports because of supplying Ukraine, Israel. A lot of the European countries are arming up in a big way as a consequence of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Poland, in 1 year, made deals with the U.S. to buy $40 billion worth of weaponry, which is significantly bigger than their entire defense budget. So whether those deals will stick or not is not clear, but it's boom times almost across the board. So to have almost record Pentagon budget and large arms exports is unusual. Some of the other big booms in arms sales were when the Pentagon budget was coming down after Vietnam, after the Cold War. The arms sales kind of helped fill the gap of reduced Pentagon spending. But now it's going up on both fronts. And it seems like, at least for the moment, we're in a bit of a shift where weapons exports are a substitute for boots on the ground. But that also means, when you're fighting a war, you're spending money feeding the troops, transporting the troops, and so forth. So a smaller portion of what you're spending goes to arms companies. But when your main role is just fueling conflicts with weapons, the companies get a bigger share of what's being spent.
This Pentagon buildup, what's the nature of that? What's that directed at? What's the composition of it?
Well, if you want money in Washington, you just say China, and that's what they're talking about. There's a big nuclear weapons buildup, which has been underway for a while, which is supposed to spend about $2 trillion over 30 years. They're trying to build up the Navy to be a bigger presence in the Pacific. They're starting to go into AI-related weapons, although a lot of the development money for that is coming from venture capital firms, and they're pushing the Pentagon to spend more. And then, you know, there's still, between direct military personnel and reserves, about 2 million military personnel to be drawn upon, paying them and doing health care and so forth is also expensive. And then with 750 military bases, transport, support services, it's about, you know, the Pentagon budget is over $900 billion now, and I would say about half of it goes to contractors. And of the money going to contractors, the bulk of it is weapons or weapons R&D, but there is also all kinds of mundane things, just support services, there's food service and cutting lawn at the Pentagon or whatever, but a lot of it is weapons.
I'm speaking with William Hartung, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute.
When you say China, what do they have in mind? What kind of weapons are they aggregating against China?
Oh, Lord. One school of thought is you need more aircraft carriers, destroyers, long-range missiles. And there are all these scenarios for, quote-unquote, winning a war with China, which is not a likely outcome. The likely outcome is just...
That's psychotic.
It's like disaster for all sides. And plus, oh, by the way, both countries have nuclear weapons. But then the... You know, the New Age militarists in Silicon Valley and some in the Pentagon are saying, well, the way to beat China is be quicker, build more nimble weapons, driven with artificial intelligence, cheaper, more reliable, to be replaced more quickly, and all being done in the first tranche in a few years. Now, the last weapon that they said was going to be revolutionary was the F-35, which was first launched in 23 years ago. And it's still not ready for prime time. So how they're going to suddenly change their operating procedures to be that much quicker, that much cheaper, is all based on kind of techno-fantasies, that somehow these Silicon Valley companies are a new breed, which certainly is their marketing phrase. But a lot of them, of course, are, even if you looked objectively, kind of crazy. I mean, Peter Thiel is spending money on how to live forever. Elon Musk wants mass colonization of space. Palmer Luckey runs Anduril as an early 30s kid who goes to work in sandals and Hawaiian shirts and is basically a gamer who decided it would be fun to make weapons. I mean, he's got the biggest video game collection in the world. He's been buying abandoned missile silos because he wants to make a ICBM museum. He calls himself a warrior. So it's different. The big companies are willing to make the money and lobby for it and so forth. But their leaders are more circumspect for the most part. They're not like beating the drums for war. And some of the more hawkish tech bros are very much doing that. And they think they're going to be our saviors. Many of them have sort of scoffed at the concept of democracy because it gets in the way of powerful, smart people fixing problems.
Yes, problems of their own creation. Now, Eric Schmidt is all over this, isn't he?
Yeah, and he's interesting. He's got a different public persona. He presents himself as more thoughtful. He acknowledges there's risks involved. He's advised the Pentagon on how to make rules about this stuff. But if you dig a little deeper, he's a walking conflict of interest because his companies invest in this stuff, build this stuff. He's got a company that was secretly testing military drones in Northern California. The rules that he made, he was on a Pentagon advisory board that helped make the rules for AI-driven weapons and so forth, are pretty loose. They're almost like verbal wishes, not an enforceable kind of agreement. He was a big fan of Henry Kissinger, Leighton Kissinger's wife, and they actually wrote a book together called AI and Our Human Future.
Oh, yeah, I saw a program they did at the Council on Foreign Relations. It was just an amazing pairing.
If Henry Kissinger is your font of wisdom, you know you're in trouble. And they're all about how artificial intelligence is going to change life as we know it. maybe it will, maybe it won't, but, you know, are they really the best ones to assess it?
Well, I loved Schmidt saying that, yeah, maybe a problem for climate change, but we can build the AI, and then AI will fix the climate, which is just...
Oh, yeah, but a lot of these systems, of course, use immense amount of power, which is rarely mentioned. They also don't talk much about who's going to build this stuff, and where, and under what conditions.
What do they have in mind with AI? What's it going to do?
There's kind of a philosopher king of the superficial, Eric Schmidt type, but military strategist named Kristen Brose, used to work for John McCain. Now he's called chief strategy officer at Anduril, which is the tech company run by Palmer Luckey. And he has a book called Kill Chain. And boiled down, basically what he says is the winners of the next wars are the ones who can reduce the time between finding the target and killing it. And so on the one hand, they say, well, we're going to keep humans in the loop, but try to be as quick as possible. You have to take humans out of the loop. It's kind of just a souped-up version of so-called revolution of military affairs, where it's about superior information, superior intelligence, quicker strike, and also the idea that human involvement would be more limited, not just drones, but pilotless fighter planes, ships that can operate without crews, combat vehicles that can do the same. And this is all on the premise that all this stuff is going to work. You know, Andrew Coburn has done a lot of good writing based on sources in the Pentagon. He says a lot of this stuff doesn't exist yet, could well be shoddy, not work as advertised. And that to some degree, it's all a con game. I don't know for sure if that's the case, but if it is, it's kind of the worst possible scenario because they're kind of getting in China's face about how we're going to beat you. And if they don't really have anything, they're just spurring an arms race with a country that's... I mean, if China wanted to spend more, they could. They haven't chosen to so far. But if you're going to say you're going to bury them with new weapons, they'll invest more in the same thing.
They're no slackers when it comes to technology either. So this is kind of a lot of delusion involved, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, they crank out more physics and technically trained PhDs. They spend a lot on R&D. They couldn't match the U.S. in traditional weapons necessarily, you know, big ships and tanks and so forth. But they're pretty good at the new things, you know, the more high-tech weaponry. And so the one thing that has a grain of truth of the Hawks is that China could get ahead of the U.S. in this stuff under some scenarios, which is why it would be better to have dialogue about how this stuff is used and not just throw all your eggs in the basket of a new arms race.
Some of this talk, like the AI and the technology more generally, it sounds like what Rumsfeld was saying, what, 25 years ago. Am I right to feel that echo?
Yeah, and of course, technology is not the only factor. They had the revolution of military affairs. They had precision-guided weapons. They had better communications. They still essentially lost the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan against relatively lightly armed forces that knew the terrain, knew the culture. You know, they were spending on expensive bombs and missiles, and their vehicles were being blown up with improvised explosive devices. So in Vietnam, they had the electronic battlefield, which was to find every member of the Viet Cong. They found ways around it. Reagan promised an impenetrable shield so no missile could ever hit the United States. Still doesn't work. So every generation, they kind of trot out a new technical idea. When the real question is, if you're going to fight stupid wars, you're probably going to lose a lot of them. And it would be better to rethink your strategy and whether trying to be the dominant military force in the world is really the best way to protect the country. But, of course, that's not what the arms companies are preoccupied with.
It looks like Israel is serving both as a test market, but also a part of the sales effort for this kind of advanced weaponry. And the Iron Dome and all that business.
Ukraine and Israel are supposed to be show the way to the wars of the future. But in the case of Israel, they're slaughtering a much less, you know, militarily powerful adversary, and they're mostly just killing civilians wantonly. In Ukraine, some of the weapons they were bragging about ends up didn't work that well. There were some small drones. Wall Street Journal looked at it. They were so brittle and hard to maintain and expensive that the Ukrainians stopped using them and started buying drones from the Chinese. So, you know, using Ukraine as a model of why this weapon is these weapons are so great requires a little bit of tunnel vision and just kind of ruling out the negative examples.
Trump seems intoxicated by the Iron Dome.
Yeah, which I think has some capabilities, but, you know, it didn't stop October 7th. There's always kind of asymmetric ways that non-state groups can evade or do damage despite all the high-tech systems that larger powers invest in.
And then Israel, of course, is dropping, 2,000-pound bombs on refugee camps, so that's not real high tech.
No. I mean, realistically, to level Gaza or bomb Lebanon, the kind of war they're fighting doesn't require kind of high-tech weapons. And when they've used them, the argument used to be, if you have more precise weapons, you can reduce civilian casualties. Clearly, that's not an interest of the Israeli military because they're hitting hospitals, they're killing journalists, they're killing aid workers. It's really shocking. I mean, it's hard to be shocked, of course, in war, but they paid no price for really doing all kinds of things that charitably can be called war crimes. And many people, including the founder of Human Rights Watch, have said unequivocally that they're engaged in a genocide.
And it seems like there are absolutely no dissenting voices in Washington. I'm old enough to remember the Vietnam War days. There are a few distinguished high-profile dissenters from the conflict, but now it's just like, it seems like everybody's an uber hawk in Washington. Is there any voice of sanity around?
A handful. Bernie Sanders has a resolution to block the next big arms sale, but that sale would involve deliveries over many years. There hasn't been really a critical mass to block the aid itself or the deliveries. And a lot of Democrats that might have been against if it was done by any other country have lined up behind it. Likewise, the Libertarian Republicans have this selective kind of opposition to intervention. They don't like aid to Ukraine. They're all in an aiding Israel. They're all in an exaggerating the threat from China. Some of them want to bomb the drug cartels in Mexico. So there's like a school of thought that says, there's this non-interventionist wing of the Republican Party. Only if you have the most flexible definition of non-intervention does that really make any sense.
The Biden administration disputed your accounting of this aid flow, right? But what did they have to say, and what did they get wrong?
Well, they got asked in a press briefing, and they kind of said, they're comparing apples and oranges. There's things that don't belong there. If they were really meant anything, they probably meant the study looked at direct military aid to Israel and the costs of the buildup in the region, more carriers, missile wars with Houthis and so forth. Now, if Israel hadn't invaded Gaza, none of that would have been necessary. But if you want to segregate it, we segregate it. So if you argue that shouldn't be part of it, okay, it's $70.9 billion instead of the $22 plus that is aggregated in the report. But of course, when the reporter asked the spokesperson what the number was, he had no answer because they have no interest in telling us the number. And in fact, the Washington Post found some months into the war, they had made 100 deals with Israel that go under the threshold for reporting them to Congress. If it's a certain amount of money, Congress has to know what you're selling, what it costs, et cetera. But if you go below that threshold, there's no need to report. So to do that 100 times is obviously an attempt to keep Congress and the public in the dark. So essentially, they may not be keeping track, which would be irresponsible, or they may just be trying to hide the true costs. And either way, the main point is they're supporting what at a minimum is criminal behavior that has cost probably 40,000 lives directly and tens of thousands more because of starvation. People haven't been counted yet because they're buried in the rubble, possibility of disease. And even if they stop bombing tomorrow, some of these other conditions would still be causing deaths until they could find ways to feed people reliably, rebuild the medical infrastructure, and so forth. So it's unconscionable. And the fact that, there'll be coverage that says, they don't have any leverage when they're not using the biggest force of leverage they have is just, would be laughable if it wasn't so outrageous. And so when Tony Blinken says things like, we're promoting the rules-based international order, nobody should take that seriously. And in fact, U.S. diplomats and the U.S. government in the future, if they talk about human rights and rules and so forth, will have very little credibility with most governments in the world. And also the idea that, they don't like the U.S., but they need us, is also called into doubt because the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were disastrous. They say they support countries defending themselves, and then they support a genocide on the part of Israel. So, they're not going to be credible. They're not necessarily going to inspire fear. So they're kind of hastening the decline of the United States, and it would be better if they could decline gracefully and not cause so much damage along the way.
That was William Harting of the Quincy Institute. He's co-author of a paper published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University. A few footnotes. Not only does the Pentagon spend gobs of money, it doesn't really have a clear idea of how much. Its books are a mess. The whole operation had never been audited until the GAO attempted one for the first time in 2018. It failed completely. It's failed 5 subsequent audits because things are such a wreck that they defy scrutiny. The military can't account for 61% of its $3.5 trillion in assets, but hey, let's just keep writing them blank checks. Bill mentioned the contribution of Palantir. Palantir is a surveillance and data firm co-founded by Peter Thiel. Its name was drawn from the Lord of the Rings, as are many things in Thiel's universe. It was funded with an early contribution from the CIA's venture capital arm. J.D. Vance is essentially Thiel's political protege, and he could well become president should Trump win on November 5th. Trump is no youngster, and he doesn't look to be in tip-top health. Here's a little clip of what Thiel thinks about Armageddon. A couple of weeks ago, I played a clip of him doubting longevity of democracy, comparing us to 1920s Germany, and implying that Germany's anti-democratic turn in the 1930s, to put it mildly, might be a model for our future. On the topic of Armageddon, he seems to think it has some underappreciated charms. I haven't edited out his many verbal missteps, as I might for someone I respected. If you could watch the video, you'd see someone who looked to be on some heavy stimulants, and the miscues give an oral flavor of his crazed demeanor.
You know, I should not need to remind you that in the sort of quasi-mythological New Testament account, the slogan of the Antichrist is peace and safety, and that we're told that there's nothing worse than Armageddon, but perhaps there is. Perhaps we should fear the Antichrist. Perhaps we should fear the one-world totalitarian state more than Armageddon.
There's Peter Thiel. It's a bold voice that will say a word in behalf of Armageddon. It'd be interesting if some reporter asked Vance if he agrees, but our reporters don't do that sort of thing. And that Henry Kissinger-Eric Schmidt confab at the Council on Foreign Relations, which I listened in on, was quite something. Schmidt sounded like the former Google CEO he is. Kissinger, though, was trying to play the grave humanist, quoting Spengler and exuding a ponderous moral seriousness, as if he weren't a war criminal. And a final footnote. Chris Brose, the chief strategy officer of Anduril and the author of The Kill Chain, whom Bill mentioned, is a former senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Very peaceful. And a fun fact about his boss, game designer turned weapons designer Palmer Luckey. Besides being a Dungeons & Dragons guy, he's the brother-in-law of the egregious Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz. Our leaders. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. That was some of Kehla, K-H-E-L-3-A, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, from the forthcoming album Maghreb by friend of Behind the News, Bergsonist. A lot of people on the left, me included, think that a lot of people view work as a curse and their jobs as hellish. I've been reading about alienation and exploitation for decades. Here's a contrary view from Scott Sheeman, a professor of sociology at the University of Toronto. He's surveyed scores of thousands of workers and consistently finds that most people like their jobs. As you'll hear from his endorsement of unions, he's no right-winger. I'm not sure what to make of all this, but it's a point of view worth thinking about. I'll be on the lookout for some alternative views in the coming weeks. Scott Sheeman.
Some years ago, the late David Graeber got a lot of attention with a book whose title I can't say on the air, or the FCC will fine the station. People hate their jobs, work is terrible, and this is a truth that is not widely known enough, according to the late David Graeber. Is that true? Do people really hate their jobs that much?
Part of why I've started studying this topic was I noticed a trend where people were really exaggerating or overestimating the extent to which they believe other people hate their jobs. But personally, most people are quite fine. There's a big chunk of people who are extremely or completely satisfied. And then historically, there's always been a small share of the population that's not at all or not too satisfied. The question of whether they hate their jobs, I mean, hate has that more emotional tone to it. A lot of people maybe are just sort of floating through like, meh, it's, you know, it's neither great nor lousy or awful. But I definitely have been interrogating Graeber's thesis and finding that it's quite exaggerated for sure. But the problem that I'm noticing is more people believe it. Again, not about themselves, but about the broader reputation of work out there.
Okay, so what exactly have you found? You find pretty high levels of at least satisfaction, if not enthusiasm.
Yeah, so broadly speaking, I study nationally representative samples of Americans and Canadians, and I usually partner with public opinion firms like YouGov or Angus Reid Global and closely try to get big samples, usually over 2,000, 3,000, sometimes 5,000. So collectively, since 2019, I've been collecting more than, say, it's about 40,000 cases now in Canada and the U.S., and just repeatedly asking questions about how they feel and think and how they talk about the different qualities of work in their life. So I start with the foundational one, which is job satisfaction. And I ask the classic question that's been asked since the 1970s, all in all, how satisfied would you say you are with your main job? And the categories are very satisfied, somewhat satisfied, not too satisfied, and not at all satisfied. And I consistently find that in Canada and the United States, almost identical numbers, 79%, roughly 80%, say that they are somewhat or very satisfied. I asked follow-up questions where I asked people to imagine if they could guess. I forced them to guess. Otherwise, a lot of people will just say they don't know. But I say, you know, how do you think most Americans or most Canadians would answer that same question? And the gap is dramatic. The vast majority of people believe that most other people would say not at all satisfied or not too satisfied. And so I call it a perception glitch, which is related to what Paul Krugman and Derek Thompson and others have described about people's perceptions of the economy, which is everything's terrible out there, but I'm relatively fine. And so that gap kind of translates over to work. And then I've asked other ones about stress, feeling underpaid, the quality of relations between employees and management. I really have been bugged by the quiet quitting concept. I think it's bunk, and I've tested that as well and found a massive glitch. People think they're not quiet quitting, but they believe everybody else is. And so, and I could go on, turnover intentions, job security, on item after item, indicator after indicator, the quality of people's own personal jobs, again, broadly speaking, is more positive than what they think is going on out in the broader public. And I mean, we can get into some reasons if you'd like.
Yeah, but now you said these surveys, the same question has been asked since the 1970s. So what have we seen over the last 40 years or so?
The glitches have not been asked. So the same questions about people's own personal qualities have been asked. And, you know, for example, like stress, job satisfaction, feeling underpaid, and so on. And one of the things that's really jumped out to me is after all of the changes and after all of the wild fluctuations in the labor market and all the chatter about the culture of work changing, people's attitudes and perceptions are remarkably stable. In fact, I'm writing a book about it now where I'm sort of shocked at how after 50 years, not much has changed for a lot of people. I mean, around the edges, yes, but the broad overall top line numbers haven't changed. And I'm talking here specifically about people's own personal evaluations of their own conditions, not the perception glitches, which I wish we had data on because I'd love to see if anything's changed on that front. But I can't find anybody that's asked any of those kinds of questions in the past. Now, I am going to continue to track these. You know, I'm particularly interested in the American election and have noticed that as we approach, this could be good news for Harris, that some of the negativity does seem to be fading a little bit. But I'm going to go into the field with another big survey in October. And then I'm going to continue these surveys through to 2030 to just see a whole decade snapshot of, you know, from 2020 to 2030, what's been happening with these qualities.
Now, I noticed one of your surveys, though, something like 60% of the respondents said they felt underpaid. So the satisfaction, does that extend to the pay level?
Definitely one of the biggest predictors of satisfaction is whether people feel underpaid. In fact, the narrative of people feeling underpaid, overworked, and insecure was a steady trio that we heard going through the Great Resignation. And in fact, a lot of people speculated, but didn't really show it, that the reason why people were quitting, quote unquote, quitting during the Great Resignation was because of those things. Look, I mean, if you look back at the data, a good chunk of people always feel at least a little bit underpaid. And part of that is, you know, everybody wants a little more money, right? And especially when cost of living is going up, that makes more sense. But again, what I found was severe underpayment was quite low personally for people. I think, I don't have the data right in front of me, but I believe it was only about 25% say that they feel underpaid a lot. So severe underpayment. But when you ask people what they think most other Americans would say on that, the gap is massive, where I think a majority, again, believe that most other people out there feel severely underpaid. And so it's all part of that negative rhetoric, bad vibes, vibe session, whatever it's been called, you know, for the past couple of years, of just a negative funk that seems like to be a residual of the Great Resignation and the pandemic.
There's an old public opinion pollster trick of asking how people feel other people think or feel when there's a possibility that the opinions offered might be disreputable or put one in a bad light. Do you think any of that is going on here?
Not totally sure the question, but...
For example, like, people don't want to sound like malcontents. They projected that everyone else, because they didn't admit themselves that they're malcontents, because it's
a
disreputable thing, yeah.
I see what you're saying. So in other words, somebody who says I'm very satisfied personally, but then says most other people are not at all satisfied. Are you saying they're actually really not satisfied, and they're projecting that out onto other people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a trick that pollsters use, I've read about. So I was just wondering if you think any of that might be going on here.
I don't think so. I do think that sort of from a social psychological perspective, there could be, you know, all of these biases that we have, like self-serving bias and, you know, social comparison, downward social comparisons, for example, would be I'm better off than you. So if I went to the gym and I looked around and I felt like I was in better physical shape, that would be downward social comparison. And I should feel better because of that. But I'm not really noticing people feeling any better about making these downward social comparisons. But that is an interesting question about, it's very it's Freudian or something, where people are actually projecting out. In other words, the negativity about everything else is terrible is actually just a reflection of what's happening inside. I don't think that's the case, because the personal evaluations have actually been quite stable over time on a lot of these indicators. I think there's an exaggeration or an overstated case of negativity about work, that we just love to hate work. Sort of a sociology of hating work is a paper that I'm working on right now. And I guess part of that is, you know, could also be fueled a bit by social media now, where everybody's on, you know, as I'm reading something this morning about, like, according to TikTok, blah, 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 and the journalist had extracted the TikTok videos as symbolizing almost like data from a nationally representative sample. It's like, that's not, you know, TikTok is not broadly representative of the population the way that our surveys are.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Scott Scheman. Now, the Great Resignation now passed mostly. I've actually looked at the quit rates over time, and there were earlier surveys before the current one that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does that showed quit rates very much on a level or even higher in earlier decades than what we saw at the peak of the Great Resignation. So it could be that the JOLTS series, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey that the BLS does, is just biased low because of the time period it covers. But that aside, it was widely interpreted as a symptom of dissatisfaction, but you could also read it as workers taking advantage of tight labor markets to move into better jobs, which would increase the net satisfaction rating. So how do you interpret the Great Resignation?
I mean, that's a great question. I've been really sitting with this for a long time, because, you know, as the pandemic was unfolding and the Great Resignation, I follow sort of the cultural chatter about work and, you know, all the different anti-work neologisms and anti-ambition stuff. You know, this is the era of anti-ambition, if I saw that headline one more time. But yeah, no, I think the way that the Great Resignation was portrayed, I wrote a paper on this, a lot of the main media, the most disseminated media, really targeted the quote-unquote personal causes. So I like what you said there, that the interpretation of the personal causes of the jolts or the massive amounts of job switching often were very, very negative. Again, like burnout was a big one. Everybody's burned out. And the word everybody's really, really important here. There was prevalence inflation, where instead of being more mindful of the more precise shares of the population that were feeling something, they were vastly exaggerated with terms like everybody. Why is everyone so unhappy at work all the time? Like those kinds of headlines. And I get it, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, or we want to click on those as opposed to, you know, more positive ones. But I agree with you. I think if you look at the data more closely, it wasn't a quote unquote, take this job and shove it economy, which was a headline. It was more of like, oh, I want a little bit more money. I want a little bit more flexibility. And the labor market conditions were right for that. And in fact, I actually have been tracking turnover intentions. That is people's perception of their own likelihood of making a move in the next year or two. And there wasn't a lot of movement on that. So what had really happened was just the people that had always said they were very likely to seriously consider making a jump just finally did make that jump when the conditions became right. But again, you know, part of what I'm interested in is the whole culture of the way that we, quote unquote, we people in their conversations and, you know, around the water cooler, or especially on social media, the way that's portrayed was dramatically exaggerated and negative. And so I think that really shaped the discourse about work. And so I've just been fascinated by that.
Part of the Graeber argument wasn't just people hate their jobs, but that their work is meaningless. Do you have any sense of how meaningful or meaningless people find their work?
I've asked questions about people's personal evaluations of the meaning in their work, meaningful work. I've asked it in a positive way, how often do you feel that the work that you do is meaningful? I've also asked it in the negative way, which is, you know, the Graeber thesis, which is most of the things that I do on my job are meaningless. And I can say that 80% on average, again, this is just top line numbers. I'm not going down into the weeds of different occupations, but the top line numbers consistently suggest that roughly 75% to 80% of both Canadians and Americans think personally their own jobs and the work that they do on average is meaningful. It's not always in every moment, you know, blissful, but what relationship or what role is ever really that perfect all the time? However, again, there's a massive perception glitch here, which you could argue confirms that people have embraced Graeber's thesis, which is most people believe that most other workers are in less meaningful or even meaningless kinds of jobs. And again, that's troubling. I find that actually stands out as one of the most problematic findings in my research that I'm, again, trying to unpack in the book.
15 years ago, my wife read a book about women workers at Walmart, and she had talked to a lot of them. And they were suffering terrible sex discrimination, sexual harassment by the boss. But despite that, they actually kind of liked their jobs. They liked dealing with the public. And you would not expect that from a Walmart worker necessarily, but it was a striking finding that she had.
Yeah, in fact, one of the things that has always troubled me about the narrative is how a lot, and I almost think it's a bit of an elitist kind of argument, which is, oh, people in sort of blue collar or quote unquote lower status jobs couldn't possibly find their work meaningful or get anything positive out of it. And people have even gone so far as to say, well, for them, it's just a paycheck and it's nothing more. And my data, I've dug really deep into that question about, you know, is a job just a job, nothing more than a paycheck? And it's just not true that people in those blue collar jobs, lower, quote unquote, lower status jobs, don't find anything other than a paycheck as worthwhile. And yeah, I've talked to a lot of those people in different related to that kind of scenario you were describing. And I've really been, frankly, like uplifted by a lot of the positivity. Now, to be clear, there are, again, in any relationship, there are negatives. There are things that definitely could be improved. And, you know, that's the whole thing about unions. You know, workers need protections, and that's an important thing. We should be mindful of that. But I just feel like it's been exaggerated. And the bigger question is also how we react back to that exaggeration. And that's a bit troubling as well. In other words, trying to take Work's reputation down doesn't do anybody any good.
And what has work from home done?
That's a big question. I mean, in one chapter in the book, it's all about how people relate to each other. And one of the benefits of work beyond just the money is the people. In fact, when I ask people across the spectrum, I ask them either to imagine a world where they're not working, or I ask them when they've been laid off or retired, what did they miss most about the work? The number one answer by far is some variant of the people. And I don't feel like, even though you might say, well, that sounds so obvious, it might be obvious, but I don't feel like we take advantage of that, especially in an era where there's a lot more talk about the loneliness epidemic, aloneness, disconnection from key institutions, religiosity going down, the whole bowling alone idea. Well, work might be one of the last organized places where people make those kinds of connections. And the working from home piece is important because what I've seen in my data is, look, a lot of upsides, especially I don't have to commute. I don't have to, get ready so much, prepare clothes and all of that all the time. I can stay at home and there's a lot more flexibility. The downside is that there is a hit to people's feeling like other people take a personal interest in them. And this is especially true for younger workers who are just starting out, who actually need those kinds of early, deep mentoring kinds of relationships. Or frankly, even if it's not that deep, there are elements of socialization that happen in the workplace that you just can't get anywhere else. And I argue in the book that when it comes to this kind of socialization, nothing replaces work. People push back and say, oh, what about volunteering or other? It just isn't the same. There are successes and failures, and actually, frankly, even communicating with other people that is only happening in the job. And when that's happening constantly through Zoom or never in person or rarely in person, it really creates problems. The last thing I'll say about this is we found in our research that people who worked from home actually had less insight about how their other coworkers were feeling. And so they tended to exaggerate the negativity even more because they didn't have that in-person sense of, connectivity with other people. And so there's a lot there I could go on about that. But the work from home thing has been massive. And I think the pendulum's swinging back where I've said this from the beginning. I think that the work from home thing is just going to be a blip in history. I think we're going to go back.
There had been a generalized fraying of social ties before COVID, and then the pandemic really seems to have accelerated that. And I do wonder if a lot of the push for working from home is a sign of alienation and fragmentation as much of an impulse towards autonomy and flexibility and freedom.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting use of alienation because, usually, Marx was talking about it in terms of you felt alienated from the product and the process, but here it's literally not connected to other people. I mean, yeah, during the pandemic, I remember teaching and, looking on a Zoom screen to like 50 blank black, screens. And I was just sitting there thinking, Jesus, if this is the future of my teaching, I think I'm done because it's so alienating. I don't even know if anybody's there looking back at me. There is a personal preference side to this. I mean, some people I talk to, I ask people who worked from home, what did they miss most about the office? And what was interesting is some people who said, I thought I was an introvert and I believed I was an introvert. I found out I really ended up missing people. I think, especially people who lived alone and didn't have anybody at home. And the pandemic had that kind of social experiment side to it, which was, you couldn't do anything else. So it kind of held everything else constant. And then working from home was the sole experimental design. But people were really surprised at how much they missed work. They missed the people side of work. And those are just intangibles that behind alienation is, I think, a desire that we have for connection. And I think that fraying was happening before the pandemic. I do think the pendulum's swinging back. I'm noticing people desiring that a bit more and recognizing the power of having some potential friendships at work.
And finally, what about gig work? What does that do? What's the mental state of people who do that?
Well, I haven't focused as much on gig work. I mean, we have a few pieces on that. I'd say that it's complicated because the people that are doing gig work and that they're fully depending on gig work for their livelihood, their, you know, gig work in itself is their main job. That puts a lot more pressure. They tend to feel more stress and more anxiety and more problems associated with losing that autonomy. The people that are kind of picking it up on the side, it just doesn't seem like there's much of an effect. So what I'm getting at there is kind of a dependency factor. People that are depending on gig work for their main source, they're a bit more precarious than others who are just sort of like, yeah, I'm picking it up on the side. Yeah, gig work's an interesting question because it really raises new issues around what the meaning of autonomy is. A lot of people go into gig work thinking that, oh, it's very flexible. But then is there a hidden dark side to that flexibility where you're actually still tied to algorithms and all the different forms of surveillance that might happen?
People don't like being surveilled.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. if you're driving for Uber, you're heavily surveilled.
Yeah. And back to the work from home thing. I mean, people also that issue of like, if employers can't see you, they might want to have a sense of like, are you actually working? And so there's like greater autonomy in terms of working from home comes with that other potential boomerang effect of, well, we still want to have some sense of what's actually happening while we're paying you for your time.
I was Scott Sheeman, a professor of sociology at the University of Toronto. Let's go out with this, some from a new album by the pianist, my old neighbor in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Bruce Brubaker. It's his second album based on the music of Brian Eno. This version of Music for Airports uses a piano whose strings are sounded not by fingers, but by an electronic bow hovering above them. Till next week, bye.